now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck. Round four of the Six Nations is in the books. Plenty to discuss on the pod today with Will Kelleher, who joins me in the studio, and Al Dimmock, who is back from an adventure to Spain.
Yes, CCC, nos vamos a París.
Go on, tell us all about it.
So I was in Madrid to watch the Rugby Europe Championship showdown, the Iberian Derby between Spain and Portugal. A winner takes all clash. Would go through to the Rugby World Cup, and Spain are going to their first Rugby World Cup since 1999, and they were partying like it was 1999. Awesome. After winning, an unbelievable atmosphere. First time I've been to Madrid to see a game, and it was, I don't know what it was an antidote to, but well, actually, I can tell you what it was an antidote to. It just felt completely uncynical, the whole thing. It just felt really pure, and if I sound a bit about that, then it was just great fun. It was a hell of an event. There was a lot at stake. It was a really entertaining match, and the atmosphere was fantastic. You know, you can keep your flame machines and your booze-sponsored pundits on the sideline. Give me Life is Life blasting on the tannoy, bit of Offspring, which came out of nowhere, and a lad in a Spain shirt, three sizes too small, screaming Vamos and España constantly. It was great fun. I loved it.
Was the king there? Did I hear the king was there?
If he was, I didn't see him.
No, you weren't sitting next to him.
No, I was not in the royal box. No,
didn't you? When they had the post-match press conference, your phone got soaked in beer.
Yeah, so they so they had the top table, and they were coming in, and they could hear the door just and giggling behind me on the side. Now the irony of this is that I had my phone down recording. I don't speak a lick of Spanish, so it was no need for it to be up there. But the guys came in with a couple of bottles of cava, soaked the head coach and the captain, and everything got drenched. And thankfully, my phone survived, but it was almost a casualty. But you know, that just summed up everything about it, and it was, you know, I'm sure we could talk about the fact that it's great to just see a different team in a Rugby World Cup, because Rugby World Cups can feel very samey. It's great to see the value of what it is. It's great to celebrate a division underneath the Six Nations, because we get caught up in just focusing on the same six to ten teams constantly in rugby, and you know, it was a good opportunity to shine a spotlight on that. But also, it's just a good story with Spain, because I think you might remember 4 years ago the debacle in the last Rugby World Cup qualification. It was them versus Belgium. It descended into madness. The referee was caught up in the middle of it. People were saying whether the result was fair, and it all fell apart. And that's really rankled in Spain since then. Last year, in their qualification process, one of their players, Kawa Liuma, passed away in a tragic accident. He fell from a height in Amsterdam after one of their games, and sadly passed away. And it's made for a really strange build up to this one. So, as you can imagine, everything involved in the mix there in Madrid yesterday, just a dead emotional time.
And it's teed up another big game for them next week. They head to Tbilisi to play Georgia. Winner wins the Rugby Europe title, but the World Cup qualification was done over 2 years.
Yeah, so it's a strange setup, but it takes a little bit of explanation. The World Cup qualification process is done over 2 years. Because of what's happened with Russia, all their future results have been decided. They won't play any more part because of obviously the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. That meant that Georgia, from their 2 year span, had qualified. Spain, in winning this one for their 2 year process, had qualified. Portugal could have done it, And unfortunately, it was one of the results last year that really meant that this was a bridge too far for them, because they were leading against Romania and then let that one slip by. And that result means that it was Spain that go through this year based on their fine form. But looking at the isolation of this, if you stick with me, the isolation of this year's competition standalone, Spain are top. Georgia have not had a great year. They drew with Portugal at the start of this whole process. There's some question marks about their performances so far. They struggled to see it through against Romania, but they did win at the weekend as well. So if Spain go to Tbilisi and get a result, just caps off an incredible journey for them.
And their reward already is to join South Africa, Ireland and Scotland in Pool B at the World Cup. And Georgia are in with Wales, Australia and Fiji.
Same pool
again.
As last time. Yeah
again. Will, we've before we go on to Will, the night that you said the celebrations were good, did you end up in the same place as the Spanish team?
No, I had to fly back last night.
Back to get here for the pod. I like that.
I'm dedicated to the
On a little note, though, I don't know if everyone else saw, but the Spanish, largely football newspaper, Marca, had the Spanish rugby team on the front.
Yeah, that's good.
Which is amazing, isn't it, for impact?
Yeah, and it's... I did ask the head coach of Spain about this, Santiago Santos, after the game, what this result could mean for Spain and Spanish rugby. And he said, it has felt like in the past, he used the word invisible, because rugby's just not shown that widely on television. But I'll tell you what, if you get a chance to watch the Spanish coverage of the Rugby World Cup, do it. I was sat at a table in the press box beside the commentators for that match, and a guy, Jaime Nava, who was the former captain. He was the captain when everything fell apart in the last Rugby World Cup cycle. He was going ballistic, and it was absolutely brilliant. So, in fact, I think there's a clip doing the rounds of this closing stages of that game with the Spanish commentary. It's brilliant.
What's the sort of equivalent of the commentator going goal? what's the try in Spanish? We need to work that out before 2023.
I'll have to dig out the clip. Not quite. It probably will. I was in Cardiff on Friday.
Yeah.
I understand Jonathan Davis was probably not dissimilar on the commentary on BBC, which was France holding on to beat Wales. Well, we were sitting next to each other in the press box at Twickenham on Saturday.
So weird, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You've tried valiantly, and lots of others have tried valiantly to sort of try and pick
valiantly
the bones out
like
of it.
Valiantly sounds like you've tried, but you failed.
Well, you've done in England. You've performed really well, but you've unfortunately come out with a loss.
Yeah, so we've got lots of Six Nations things to discuss. Coming up on the ruck, Joe Worsley, the former England back row and current coach at Castres, is going to join us to have a look at France and their Grand Slam quest. And we'll pick apart the rest of the Six Nations games. Jess Hayden will join us for her roundup of the women's game as they get close to their Six Nations. And we'll have our weekly God, Goddess or Devil of the Week. All right, let's start at Twickenham then, guys. England, I don't think I need to recap it, down to 14 men after 82 seconds, fought very well, and then ended up losing by a record score to Ireland at home. You said we tried to reconcile the good with the bad in the paper today. It's felt a bit like that to me throughout this whole Six Nations, which is really the thrust of what I was trying to say, that England went to Murrayfield in the first game, had the better of the game but couldn't score, lost, and then almost blew a lead at home to Wales, but sort of clung on to win. And then this game, which people who left Twickenham, their memory of it was of England's resilience and their fight and some outstanding individual performances, I thought, from players like Mara Toji and Ellis Genge and Joe Marchant, Jamie George, like, seriously good, because they just dug in and got physical and made life really hard for Ireland, who didn't help themselves, actually, I don't think. And yet, despite all of that, six scrum penalties, I mean, all of that, they conceded four tries, scored none, fell to 32-15 defeat. They now need to beat France in Paris to have any chance of finishing third.
And if they don't, it'll be the first time they finish in the bottom two back-to-back in the Six Nations since 05-06, which was a pretty grim England era.
So let's pick it all apart. The red card, do we need to debate that for very long?
No.
I mean, it was a red card, wasn't
but
it?
I think possibly a note that we could say that has been mentioned in the coverage is that he made a tackle similar to that just before.
Yeah, on Tyburn.
Charlie, yours were talking about. And also the whole narrative of this, we are going to bring physicality, the likes of which Ireland have never seen, which Eddie Jones made in the week. Is that in his head? Is that a contributing factor to a tackle like that that is just never going to be anything other than the red card?
If that is the case, then you have to focus purely on the individual's tackle technique. Exactly. Because in the opening 35 seconds of this game, Ellis Genge put a shot on Tadhg Furlong to say, I'm here, mate. I'm coming for you. Perfectly clean. Took him to the deck. There was no issue with that. But it was like a shot across the bows. Mm. You know, I'm all for people getting fired up and bringing a physical battle. But in this one, you've got to go, right, your own technique. We all know what the laws are now. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I was in Spain over the weekend. So the question, the question I put to you guys as you were there on the ground is what was the moment where the straw broke the camel's back? Was it after the hour mark when Ireland got try number three, or was it at what point was it like, okay, this is gonna go the way that we think it's gonna go?
I was sitting next to Alex and Owen Slott, and we were looking at each other, almost laughing, being like, oh my God, they might win this. Like, what the hell is going to happen if England win? And the crowd was going mental and Swing Low was going around. And I don't think I've ever seen Twickenham roar for a box kick before.
Yeah.
You know, I had old men like standing up on their seat almost, roaring, Ben Young's kicking the ball up in the air. And it was ridiculous. And then I think the thing that punctured the balloon was that Johnny Sexton kicking a penalty to put them 18-15 up. And then Ireland realised that if they kept the phase play going for long enough, they'd stretch England left, they'd stretch England right and find a gap. And they put together the longest phase play of the match, which was a 13-phase move, which ended with Conan scoring. And then that was done. And actually, I've done a little bit of an analysis-y thing on it for the Monday Mall thing for Times subscribers. And you can see, watching it back, that England forwards are totally screwed. Yeah. Like, their legs have gone, and like, fair enough, like, they've made a hell of an effort throughout the game, and you can see Itoje desperately trying to get back into the defensive line, but his legs are giving it.
That was the moment that Ireland won it. What amazed me was that, and perhaps it was their policy to try and play fast and push it around. So to rewind to the tackle,
yeah,
I'm sure he was going in upright because in both of those incidences, there'd been little offloads, you know, little passes out of, because that's how Ireland play, that's how they keep it alive, quick ball. So coming in high, he's looking to get man and ball and stop that.
Yeah.
He not only went high and clattered heads, he was also late because the ball...
And he knocked him out.
The ball had already gone, he knocked
help.
Him out for a card. But that's what England were obviously trying to do defensively, to go back to your point about physical stuff. They need to hit them hard to try and stop Ireland from playing as quickly as they like to play. And then perhaps Ireland were trying to wear England down, but it felt to me watching like they got a bit spooked by the idea of playing 14 men, which can easily happen. And they were forcing it too much, I thought. That, like, Tadhg Furlong trying to force an offload out of a tackle that wasn't there, passes that weren't sympathetic enough. And they were being rocked at the same time by England, who had narrowed down any intention to play. Mm. If you remember back, James Lowe's try, Ireland got the ball because they turned England over. England had attacked, Ireland turned them over, came back at them, picked them apart and scored. And I really felt from there, and then England lost Tom Curry, and they just thought, we have to narrow this all down. The only way we can stay in the game is to try and kick, play territory, chase really hard, use physicality. And it worked, and Ireland were rocked, and they were then trying to force it. And we were sitting there going, if they just...
keep the ball.
Keep it, just play the phases, they will outnumber England.
Yeah.
And it was that period, Colin Murray came on and just felt calmed like he just calmed it down a bit. They just played the phases and then they picked England open in that last 10 or 15 minutes. But then they win with a bonus point. Mm. They're on for the title as well going into the last weekend. And yet there's so much good to say about England, particularly their spirit and their scrummaging.
Well, because it's an interest. Yeah, I'd like to get onto the scrummaging, but just to stick with the speed of the game, because speaking to a friend of the podcast, Ross Hamilton, this morning, one of the things he highlighted was the ruck speed that obviously he's spoken a lot and we've written some about ruck speed and that being the key to creating chaos in the opposition defence. Obviously, England have already wrought their own chaos by being a man down, so it's you could say there's an inevitability of time with that. But one of the things he pointed out was just the stark contrast in ruck speed in attack. You know, it was almost a second quicker on average for Ireland than it was for England. Now, obviously, they've got to play a certain tactic, but you know, looking at the opportunities created, we can talk about tigerish defence from England and brave rearguard action. But what do you think is the root of the issues for England's attack? Is it that the ball isn't quick enough for them to use, or is it just trying to play off of errors rather than create something?
So I think this game it has to be set aside from the general concerns about England's attack, because
There are general concerns.
No, there are, we've discussed through the championship. All I was going to say was, once they found themselves in this situation, I think they worked out, I'm hoping it was the players on the field rather than the water boys telling them, but they worked out that they couldn't play at the pace that they clearly intended to, with Harry Randall taking a quick tap, and because that would just be their undoing. So they had to change tack, and they had to play behind the kick and chase and defend hard. I have seen criticism that, you know, yet again England didn't score a try, or they never came close to it. I don't think that was the way they had to play this game.
No.
They had to stick in it. In general, and early on, when they were still in that mindset, very early on, Joe Marchant made a really strong carry over the gain line. He's no Manu, but he's the only one who in that midfield is going to get... They picked Elliot Daly there. He's not even trying. He's not that physique. Yeah. It's momentum. It's speed of ball and being able to play off the back of it. And at the moment, they haven't managed to... England haven't managed to unleash carriers to get them on the front foot, to get the quick ball and allow them to exploit disorganised defence. At the moment, it feels to me they're still trying to pick apart set defences through angles and skill, which is just a lot harder to do. Now, we'll come on to it later. France managed to create an overlap where one should never have existed with a brilliant execution against Wales. But it's incredibly hard to do, and it requires the cohesion, which we all spent weeks talking about, of understanding lines of running and reading each other, which England just don't have yet. So therefore, without the go forward across the gain line, that becomes a lot harder to achieve. And that Scotland game, they had all the ball, but no penetration. You think the two tries, and against Italy, they were too sophisticated for the Italian defence. They scored five, they could have scored seven, but they were way too good for Italy playing like that. But against better organised teams, they need more punch, and that's where they scored twice. A gift at the back of a Wales line-out.
Might not have been given.
And a sharp finish off the back of a maul at Murrayfield.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of context that you've put on there to these stats that I'm going to read, but they're quite damning, really, about England's attack. And some of it is about the Ireland game, which had a different context to it. But the theme of the whole competition is Wales and Italy are the two sides that have the more profligate attacks than England. England have been into the opposition 22 on average 8 times in a match so far this tournament, and Wales and Italy are 7.3 behind them. And then if you go on points per entry, England are at 1.72, Wales are at 1.59, and Italy at 0.9. And then you go the other end of the scale, Scotland are actually top on 2.89 points per entry to the 22, France 2.35, Ireland 2.83. And just looking at the Ireland game particularly, they only were in the Irish 22 for 16 seconds in the whole match. And you just think, and there was, I can't remember the exact number for the Scotland game, but it was very low again. And you just think, if they're never getting there, they're never giving themselves a chance.
So the Scotland game was worse. I'm sympathetic to them in the Ireland game.
Yeah, sure.
It was a different set of circumstances that they had. I mean, it's by their own hand. You didn't have to tackle like that. It's still their own fault,
but
they were presented with a set of circumstances less sympathetic for the Scotland game, where they had a lot of opportunities, a lot of time on the ball and no penetration.
And in terms of point scoring as well, obviously one more game to go, we'll see what they do in France, but at the moment this is their joint worst scoring Six Nations, 88 points, the same as 2010,
one game to go. And then try scoring, they've scored seven, as we said, and five of them came versus Italy. And if they don't score another one, that would be the third worst tournament of all time in the Six Nations era. So it's a clear theme that they've got very talented rugby players who we watch every week in the Premiership who are... So if you go through it, what, the most exciting nine in the Prem, probably?
One off.
Oh, English, let's say, rather than people like Faf de Klerk.
One off, yeah. Rafi Quirk, probably.
The most attacking 10 in the league. You've got one of the most classy ball-playing centres in the league, Henry Slade. You've got Jack Noll, proven international class when he's fit. You've got Freddie Stewart, one of the best young players in the world, maybe. Mm. And it doesn't fit. It doesn't work. It hasn't
clicked.
Borne any fruit yet.
Yeah.
So there's a problem there. And whether that's Eddie Jones's problem, whether that's Martin Gleeson's problem, the attack coach, or whether that's the players individually, something isn't happening. And every week we're going to Twickenham or wherever they're playing and wanting to see the plaster ripped off, and it's not happening.
Yeah. They were supremely confident and hopeful that the Ireland game would have been the day.
Yeah.
So I spent 45 minutes with Martin Gleeson last week talking about what they're trying to layer on, what they're trying to achieve in attack, that why they're trying to do it, play this way where they can self-organise and not rely on pods, and it's difficult to achieve because you've got players coming from different clubs with different background, you know, tactical game plans. And he, you know, he's aware that they're not there, but he was talking England up. And of course, they never got a chance to try and execute it. So now they have to go and do it in Paris.
Yeah, well,
where as Wales showed, the best way to nullify France is to not play that way.
Yeah.
Is to just
outkick them cleverly. Yeah. And yeah, but maybe one last point is, whatever happens next week, the tour's Australia, and in some ways does that help because, very stereotypically, Australia away is open. It's quite running rugby, isn't it? I mean, the last series in 2016, incredible. Apart from the Melbourne game in the middle, was incredibly high scoring, wasn't it? And England started layering a bit of attack on that, didn't they? So is that where they really start to kick into gear? We'll see.
I mean, to be a bit of a stick in the mud, we obviously can't just stick it all on the back line as well, because as one unit, okay, the C word is being used an awful lot. Of cohesion, by the way, don't know. But the, you know, so much of that comes with having the ball to play with. And if England don't have the ball to play with, then, or in the circumstances that they want, it just feels like they need to be better at playing with a sometimes pretty crappy hand. And it'll be interesting to see where they go. Now, what I'm interested in, and finally, Alex, we get to the crux of things. Talk to me about the scrum. What the hell was going on there? Because I just looked up and I kept seeing people just going, oh my God, Ireland are a wet paper bag. What's happened?
Yeah.
Have we got two props in the room?
Yeah, I was going to defer to you. There are a couple of things which were obvious to me, although one of them with a bit of guidance from Alex Corbusier, who has played there in this game. He was in the England front row when they decimated Ireland 10 years ago, as was Keane Healy, who's now suffered it twice. There were two things I noticed. Tyke Furlong had a chat with the referee after about the second or third scrum penalty to argue that England were hit and chasing. So they weren't staying stable on the engage, and the ball was coming in as Sinclair, in particular, is nudging forward, and that, when you watch back, that definitely happens, certainly early on. And the other element which Corbs pointed out was that Healy's setup was wrong. So England were able to win the engage, even if they were stable. They had the stronger position, partly because Healy's feet were a bit too underneath him. He wasn't set up best for the engage, and that then gave England a strong position to be in. Where I'm from, the position we were in, and even from watching, Genge was credited with four, I think, of those penalties on Tyke Furlong. A lot of them wheeling around the scrum wheels around him. He's got Courtney behind him, who, by his own admission, is no longer a lock. He's lighter than he was. He doesn't like playing there anymore. And he's got Jack Noll flanking on the loosehead side, and England, and it wheels that way around.
That way, yeah.
Is Genge stepping out and going and swimming up the outside of Furlong, do you think, there?
That's interesting. That's one I did see quite a few stills of people going, hold on. And it did look like a split within the second rows of England in order to sort of hinge around that.
Yeah.
Certainly if I need to watch it in detail. But I find it fascinating because we've heard so much about this Ireland setup, and it's, you know, Healy had been, you know, had stepped aside to let Porter come in to that position. Would things have been very different had Porter been playing? It's all academic, but it's just a fascinating subplot to a game where, in so many other physical assets, you could potentially say that Ireland might have got there in the end anyway. But to do that with a hand behind their back, actually, it's really, you've got to say a bit of credit to them for conceding so many penalties in that set piece and still doing the job. I mean, you don't have to win beautifully every time, you just got to win, and they're still in a position to win the Six Nations, and, amazingly.
Andy Farrell afterwards was pretty careful with his words, but basically said, I have no issues about our scrum, I'm not worried about it at all. In a way that suggested that we've been done by the referee today,
the
and there's nothing we can do about it.
This next week coming, if Genge does it again to Weenie Atonio and Paul Valimse, then that's a hell of a thing to put in your back pocket.
Yeah,
if the referee's looking at it next week and goes, hang on, there's something fishy happening here.
And if they can back it up, then that's where this kind of weird scenario around England and that game in particular is really kind of, you can narrow it down to that, is England lost that game and they lost it pretty badly. And yet Jamie George is talking afterwards about individual performances being like unbelievably inspirational.
He said it was one of the proudest days of his rugby life.
And also how a lot of their feeling was, we can get more out of this game, take us into the France game, regardless of the actual result. This not on the attack, obviously, as we've discussed, but it almost felt like they were more buoyed by the way they had to play, because you've only got one option. We've got two options in that situation.
Yeah.
You roll over or you stand up. And I think they were very close to, if the Caelan Doris try had stood, they'd have been 13 or 15 nil down in 11 minutes. And then you're thinking, and Ireland are rampant. And you're thinking, this is ugly. And it comes back to a real tiny bit of very smart, perfectly timed kind of nuisance skullduggery legally from Marrow, which is just his forte. Grabbing hold of Gary Ringrose's arm just at the right moment. As soon as he picked it up, the ball spills. The try is chalked off. Joe Marchant wins a turnover, defensive turnover.
I think we're going to get to the end of the Six Nations and go, geez, Joe Marchant, the level that he's got to, particularly defensively, deserves a hell of a pat on the back. I mean, looking at it from the game next week and saying that Ireland could potentially go on to still win the Six Nations pending result in Paris, I think from where I'm sitting is looking at the way that the rate that Ireland play at when they are rampant compared to Scotland, who have according to Kevin Miller, looks at stats like this for Scotland, Scotland have conceded the most ruck penalties in the Six Nations with 25. That's a flashing warning sign for the Scots, and it's somewhere where Ireland can really make hay. And the way that they're playing now, I sometimes get annoyed when people use tackle stats in isolation, missed tackle stats in isolation, because it is, if anything, that's a statistic that needs real context around it. Because in the modern game, sometimes you want your chasers to miss tackles because they're forcing a kicker or a playmaker into a certain position that they don't want to be in. And that, well, we saw the value of the kicking battle between Wales and France, but I'm pretty sure Scotland still missed 29 tackles against Italy. And again, that's one of those where you got to be on your mettle. And we talked about Ireland, when they get comfortable in multi-phase, that was the try that broke England. Scotland against Italy, which you'd say is the easiest tie that they've got in the Six Nations, haven't looked great in multi-phase. So it'll be fascinating to see who can turn it around and play a bit different if Scotland can be the fly in the ointment and be competitive. But Ireland, I think, you know, they want to get that feel like they're rolling, and actually beating a dogged England and still getting a hefty margin of victory, I think they'll be pretty chuffed. So that just means that all eyes turn to Paris now.
Yeah, your thing about the tackles is interesting. They may have been updated, but in the immediate aftermath of Wales-France, a game that France won defensively, Wales had made more tackles.
Yeah.
According to the official stats, which seemed bizarre, because it didn't fit with how the game had unfolded.
And this is why I get a bit frustrated sometimes when we just use shallow statistics, and actually we need to delve a little deeper into those. But you know, I'll tell you what, if anything, anyone that's going to have a spotlight on him this coming weekend will be Sean Edwards and his defence and what France can achieve at home, because there's a hell of a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah, I mean, that Sean Edwards defence is remarkable, isn't it? And he's here again. He's on the cusp of possibly winning a fourth Grand Slam and something like his 52nd title in his career, coaching and playing. Ridiculous. And the great stat from that is that in this tournament, Italy have been the only team to have been ahead of France in a game. And since the 29th minute of the opening round, France have always either been level or ahead of the opposition and conceded 3 tries in second halves, and 2 of them were Ireland, and 1 was a consolation for Duane van der Merwe in Scotland when they were miles back. So the defence has been amazing.
I think it's down to that training camp with the French Foreign Legion that Sean told us he took them on. Yeah, took them too before the championship. And coming up next is our next defence coach from France, Joe Worsley, who was in Cardiff on Friday night working for the BBC, and he'll join us to preview France against England and the prospect of a first French Grand Slam in 12 years.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So that was the sound of joyous French fans in the Principality Stadium on Friday night as their team moved to one game away from a first Grand Slam since 2010, which seems remarkable. Joining us on the ruck is Joe Worsley, who was also in the stadium and spends his professional life over in France coaching in Castres and has a much better perspective on French rugby than us. Joe, thanks for joining us.
No worries, good to join you.
What did you make of that France game on Friday? It felt like it was Sean Edwards back in Wales, but you know, putting the he had his paw prints all over that game.
Yeah, certainly did. I think and we can talk more about what Sean's brought to that French team a bit later. But in terms of that performance, yes, they defended really well in the 22. They gave up very few penalties in their half, very few opportunities, which is a real sign of Sean Edwards being part of that team. But they did give enough opportunities. I think Wales probably should have won the game.
What has Sean brought to that French setup?
He's brought enthusiasm for areas of the game where they probably weren't so enthusiastic before. So despite the language barrier, he's brought motivation to defend and to chase kicks. But it's not just him. It's Gaultier had already started the process. And Gaultier has been a long time admirer of how Sean coaches teams or teams Sean's been part of. So it's not just Sean going in there. It's Gaultier's already set and trained the motion events, which was happening before Sean arrived. And Sean's just someone who could really boss that side of the game fantastically well. So whilst we're bigging up Sean here, Gaultier is also somebody who's a long-time convert to playing in that way.
As is always the way, the kind of the brighter things are what usually catch our eye, the attacking rugby, Dupont beating people, but that sort of steel underbelly is what Sean's built. And I left Cardiff on Friday thinking that they'll probably take more from winning a game that way than had they played the way that they sort of naturally played, maybe even the way they beat the All Blacks, just because going into a Grand Slam game to know you can win on the back foot and without the ball is probably massive for the development of that team.
Yeah, I don't think they changed at all how they play. I think we think about the sexy tries that France can score, but the point against Scotland, the try where he started from a counter-attack was after a kicking duel. Mm. A lot of their stuff stems from kicking duels, and the pressure they can put on opposition teams with those kicking duels is a strength of theirs. Normally, it's a strength of theirs. At the weekend, they did it really, really poorly. So that try against Scotland started because they've been in a kicking duel, and then the winger shot out the line to go for Dupont, creating a bit of space, and Dupont could recognise that. The thing about that French team is a lot of teams in international rugby kick really well for territory, and they kick fantastically well, but that French team have got probably the best running on fire at recognising the opportunities of when to play. And that's something Toulouse style, especially the guys like Dupont and Damac, who play for Toulouse, they're fantastic recognising that and going for it.
Just from what you've seen of France so far, this Six Nations, and also dispatches of England, we've just been speaking about England's failure to create a number of opportunities. What do you think they could do to unlock this French defence? Where would you be targeting?
Obviously, they're going to be... Wales changed... Of any teams changed how they played a bit. Wales at the weekend played the best pressure side of the game. The unsexy side of the game, we talk about Sean, what he brought to that Wales team when he played, obviously with Gatland as well, someone who backed that up and backed up that style of play. They've been in flux, Wales. So they've been in flux and they've gone towards a very attacking-based game with coughing up lots of errors. Now, at the weekend, they didn't do that. They shot themselves in the foot a couple of times while overplaying, giving away penalties to France. But on the whole, they were very disciplined and kicked and pressured very well. Now, is that a reaction to one game or not? We'll wait and see. But in terms of England, they've got to do the same thing to the same quality that Wales did to France and hope with that pressure and quality of kick, quality of chase, they're going to get the same opportunities coming out of the back of it. Obviously, on top of that, we're talking about their ability to attack and create chances through the attack as well. But that's going to be a far more difficult proposition because, like Wales, England are lacking a number of ball-carrying forwards and power players. We just don't have as many as we used to do. So whilst there are still players who can do a good job there, obviously the more you have, the more chance you have of creating good quality fast ball. And you saw at the weekend, every time Wales put into play a sequence of phases, they really struggled and the turnover came quite quickly. They went back phase after phase after phase in penalties. Only two times, really. One was a third or fourth phase after a launch from the kick where they should have probably scored, but Jonathan Davis dropped it. And the other one was just straight up a long sequence of play in the 22, which finished with an interception. So that power side of the game, I don't think that's not going to change for England. Like it for Wales, it was a problem for England. It's going to be the same issue. So the few chances that come their way, the turnovers and the poor kicks and the opportunities to counterattack, they're going to have to take every single one.
Now, in your time as a player, Joe, it was often common to see back rowers like yourself trying to hunt down the playmakers. In the modern game, because everything's so system-based, we see teams working as a cohesive unit. But one of the things that stood out is players like Dupont, scrum halves, really, shooting out of the line, going solo. We've seen a bit of it from Harry Randall. Sail Sharks use it. South Africa have used it. You know, what could you tell us about Antoine Dupont defensively, and when he does decide to fly, how disruptive it can be?
Yeah, he's up in the line quite a lot as well. He's in the first line a lot. I think he does it well enough that he's not there often enough to put in place chips into behind that second level where you've got the space behind the front line and the one or two players in the backfield. But when you see him shooting out the line, when you see the players you talked about shooting out the line, often it's on board that's a bit slower. So they're aware that there's going to be a defensive line ready set. They're aware that maybe the opposition 10 is trying to kick the ball. So they can really get the heat on and fly off the line. There's also an opportunity on if teams hit playing flat to the line and they still carry on doing that in a period where the nine can think about it and get himself in position, which means the ball's slow enough for him to do that. You remember seeing a lot of nines intercept the ball of Wales. Sean likes them to identify that. And if they are playing flat at the line, then maybe he can get an intercept there. But the majority of the times you're talking about is normally slowish ball. Ten's quite deep. Nine's going to really get to him quickly. So either pressure the kick or force him to pass as early as possible.
Okay.
Which gives the rest of the defence an easier situation after.
And there is one other guy I want to highlight, and it's purely because I think here in the UK we probably don't know too much about him. What can you tell me about Francois Cross and the way that he plays in that French back row?
He's very important to the team, like he is to the Toulouse team. The other players, Aldrit goes for a ton of work as well. But when Wauke plays with him, Wauke's talents lie. He's not bad at working hard. He's got a lot better. But historically, his problem was that. But he's so talented in other areas that he's still going to play. I know he plays second row at the weekend, so it's a bit different. Because Antti Jalonch can work fairly hard as well. But Cross is that dog. He's the, whilst you don't have out and out open sides in France, he's probably one of the guys who's a bit closer to being that. He's somebody who works incredibly hard, gets his head over the ball and does all the other basics of back row play very well as well.
Joe, you've been keyed into the French club scene over the last few years. What can you tell us about the changes that have happened between club and country? It seems England and France always have that battle, don't they? And what changed with Galtier coming in, the sort of project 2023? How have they kind of reconciled a few differences on that front from your perspective?
It's not so much him, it's Laporte doing. When he came in and got made president of the, he quickly moved politically to get more power over the clubs, because financially the clubs have got more clout than their federation due to a number of reasons. But through bullying, through persuading, through a number of ways, he managed to get an agreement with the French clubs, which is one of the reasons they are able to play more cohesively and better now. They're getting better coached. That's a hands down clear thing to say. But also they're getting to spend more time together. They're getting to stay together during the Six Nations. Whereas before Laporte came in, before he managed to find a way to make this work, they used to have to, week before the Six Nations, they might be playing for their club. The down week, they would have gone back. So they never knew they're going to be playing for their club midweek or not. They're traveling around. They couldn't stay together. And it's hard to explain to anyone who doesn't understand being in that situation about playing five really intense international matches and having to go to a different environment and maybe train or play. Learn all the calls, adjust to a new one is really difficult. I used to have to do it when I played, because at that point in time, we didn't have the agreement when I started with England. And it's just an incredibly tiring situation. It's dangerous as well. You pick up injuries, you're fatigued and you can't concentrate as well. The ability to get the French team together for that block of time over the Six Nations has been a huge, huge bonus for Gaultier. And he's laid back to up some quality coaching. It looks like it's paying off with a Grand Slam, and maybe paying off with a Grand Slam this weekend coming.
The Stade de France will be an incredible place to be on Saturday night, Joe. What can you give us a sense of what it would mean to French rugby to nail this? Not just maybe for now, but with the World Cup in mind, and also for French sport. at this time? Is it resonating beyond just rugby, the way this team are playing?
Yes, certainly is. I think the French really, when it comes to a national team doing well, everyone tends to get behind it, regardless of their sporting preference. Normally, that's a football rugby argument in France, like it is in England. But no one's really bothered by their loyalties. They prefer football or rugby. They just dive in on it. So when the French football team do well, everyone's out in force for them. And it's going to be the same for the rugby team this weekend. But I mean, the team itself, and they're getting pushed with this dream about what's going to happen in 23. There's a lot of talk about that all the time they meet up. They've been building up a whole thing around this. And the players, I think, have bought on, are really bought into it. And they realise the importance of a successful home team at home World Cup and what it could do for rugby in France. I think that dream is the big one that's driving them forwards. And obviously, a Grand Slam is going to be part of that. But the Grand Slam, it'll be amazing. I'm sure they'll be so satisfied to do it, but it's going to be a step towards where they want to be in 23. It's very much where they're going, and this is a step on the way there.
Joe, just a last one. I mean, it's been a long time since we've had a sort of dominant French team, and there was one in your era. As an English player going to the Stade de France, what is it like when that place is bouncing and rocking and you're sort of in their sights?
It's when they're in full force, it's a difficult environment to go into. Part of the reason is historically our physicality allowed us to win matches. And the French team were one of the global teams along with South Africa who could match us there, or sometimes better of us, you know, if they were good on the day. And that ability to strangle us and stop us playing was something the French team were always able to do. You find it very frustrating playing against them in that move, because they were capable of reacting to and creating tries out of nothing. But when they're in the mood, they could also set piece more tackle situation, really, really slow us down, and like playing against your feet in the mud. So it was difficult. It was difficult. The games moved on, but France now are kind of catching up. Dynamic pressure side of their game, they're getting better and better and better at. And they're capable of scoring at any mistake you make, turnover, set piece launches. They're very, very across the board. They've got a lot of talent. So whilst in my day, they were a team who could almost grind you down with a couple of brilliant moments, now they're really a team who can do that a bit, but they're so threatening in other areas that you have to be at the races if you want to have a hope of winning against them. We'll wait and see how it goes. I'm not sounding very positive here.
not for England, but it could be a great thing for the game if this France team can keep on playing as they are. Super Saturday looms, and it should reach its crescendo in Paris with France against England going for the title. Joe, thank you so much for joining us and giving us that all that insight. Fascinating to hear about it, and look forward to catching up soon.
Catch you later.
Coming up next on The Ruck, we'll have our weekly God or Goddess feature, but first, Jess Hayden with all the latest in the women's game.
The Premier 15s is on a break for the Women's Six Nations, but one rearranged fixture still went ahead over the weekend. Saracens, who've confirmed their top-of-the-table finish in the league, beat Gloucester Hartbury 35-20 on Sunday to put themselves 13 points clear at the top. But the biggest women's rugby match of the weekend was Wales women versus the USA. Wales received 12 full-time contracts and 11 part-time contracts in January this year, and this match, which was a warm-up for the Women's Six Nations, was their first outing as a professional and a semi-professional side. Wales led for most of the match, including a 15-0 lead in the first quarter, but the decision by head coach Eoin Cunningham to test new players led to chaos, as all 17 players named on the bench were substituted on at some point during the match. The USA made a second-half comeback and won the match 31-23. That's all the women's rugby news for this week, but if you would like to see some more women's rugby content, head to thetimes.co.uk where you can find a Q&A piece answering our readers' questions about the Women's Six Nations.
Thank you to Jess, and yeah, go give her Q&A a read on the website. We've got the Women's Six Nations is looming. Now, we've got our God, Goddess or Devil of the Week feature to wrap up this week's episode. I've got to guess where Al's going. So I'll start with Will.
Yeah, it's Route 1. Sean Edwards back at his old turf. Proper defensive performance. It was fun watching him on the. There was like Edwards cam, wasn't there, on the BBC? Yeah. And he was so animated. I would just love to be a fly on the wall of his meetings this week. It could be tasty next on Saturday against England, yeah.
Al, are we going down to Madrid?
We are. I'm going to give it to Fernando Lopez, captain of Los Leones. Spain men obviously have made it to the Rugby World Cup for the first time since 1999. He did his top table press conference at the end wearing a black t-shirt in honour of Kawa Liuma, who I mentioned before passed away. And yeah, just a huge moment for Spain. He's a bit of a figurehead there. So yeah, I've got to go that way.
I don't know if I'm going to get away with this, but one of the themes of the last few weeks in the Six Nations has been how the man of the match has been on the losing team in so many games. And I think we saw it with England. I thought Mauro Itoje was just phenomenal. Talupe Faletau, 2 weeks running, has been unbelievable for Wales against England and against France. And both times has ended up on the losing team. So my shout just goes out to all those superstars who never get the champagne because they end up being the best player on the pitch but losing.
So you're not actually going to name anyone?
Well, okay. I'll name Faletau. I'll name Faletau because I think for 2 weeks running he's been unbelievable for Wales and just hasn't been able to get them over the line on his own.
Man of the match things, what do you think the players do with the little thing they get given, like the vase or the little Heineken star or the beer or whatever? Do they have a whole cupboard full of them somewhere? Or
it probably depends who you are. Like yeah. Marrow is probably like in his garage somewhere because he's got so many of them. If you don't win that many because you're in an unsexy
position. I remember
position.
Once, actually, it was like 2005, 6, something like that, a cricket game, and there was a one-dayer in India, and Andrew Flintoff won a motorbike, and he rode it round the boundary.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he was allowed to bring it home. Like, Federer's been given a cow by Switzerland before for winning Wimbledon, I think.
Yeah.
It's a bit better than a little bit of, like, tat from a sponsor.
We'll find out. We'll ask. Will and I are off to talk to Eddie Jones in 15 minutes, so I'm not sure we'll waste a question on Eddie on what they all do with it. But if we find out, we'll report back what they do with. And some of them are the ugliest little trophies you've ever seen,
yeah,
aren't they? But
yeah.
Anyway, thank you all for joining us. We'll be back next week when we'll know who the Six Nations champions are. We'll know whether France have finally got over the line after 12 years of waiting and about three different revolutions in that period. Al, thanks for making it all the way back from Madrid. Will, good to see you. And we'll be back next week. Thank you.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.